continue on a sustainable, loving growth path,
fueled by reputation,
trust and innovation, is a peer of this and the aviation realm. Sir Tim Clark, President of Emirates Airline. And charged with eliciting Sir Tim's valuable insights is our own Max Kingsley Jones, who for his sharp wit is commonly known as Mac the Knife. Gentlemen, let's cut to the chase. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Clive. That's the polite name I'm known by. And thank you, Sir Tim, for joining us here. I was looking back, actually, when we last had Sir Tim here, I think it was 2016. Not much has happened since then, really, has it? So there's not much to talk about. So anyway, I know Emirates doesn't need any introduction, but I'm going to give a very quick one anyway. Emirates has a passenger fleet, using my company Sirium's data, of around 250 aircraft. As passenger aircraft. They've also got 14 wide-body freighters. Some of those passenger aircraft are still stored, the A380s, and there's 24 stored still, but they're coming back. And over 300 more on order, I think 310 is the figure. At the Dubai Air Show, Sir Tim was back in the Airbus and Boeing toy shop, placing 110 more orders, 90 777X, 5 787-10, and 15 A350-900s. So it's onwards and upwards. COVID's behind us. It's back to growth. And so that was really where I want to start, Sir Tim, and just talk about how you see the recovery now. We're kind of pretty much in the rearview mirror, hopefully, with that and COVID. And what the scene looks like for Emirates, the capacity growth, and the way that you see the business fully recovering and moving into that growth cycle, presumably during 2024.
Hello?
Right. Yeah. We never believed that the pandemic would bring the demand for air travel to a halt, and we never believed in the comments coming from a number of luminaries in the business that the game was over for corporate travel and all the other bits and pieces. And we planned our operation, certainly in the late 2020, to kickstart as soon as we could see an opening in the sort of pandemic armour, if you could call it that. Which is what we did. We never believed that the demand would do anything else but bounce back with a significant robustness. And I say that because we've been through a number of issues before, whether it be 9/11, whether it be the Gulf Wars, or all sorts of things. And each time there had been a problem, we'd noticed how demand roared back at some pace. Now, the longer the pandemic was in place, the more likely it is that demand would increase at such a velocity that the international air carriage, the airline industry, would not be in a position to address that. And unfortunately for us, we were a first mover. We got our fleet armed, ready to go, the 380s, etc., etc., and got them flying as quickly as we could. And as you know, a lot of countries remain closed, and they opened very, very late in the day. But of course, as soon as they did, we have seen demand unprecedented, certainly in my professional career, which is now over 50 years in this business, move at such a pace, at such high levels of pricing, which even I am quite happy to say, or perhaps ashamed to say, whichever way you look at it, that as the more we have done, the more people have responded to the airline brand, to Emirates. And the number of people who have sustained that demand in the industry, you see British Airways announcing pretty record profits the other day. The airline industry is actually in quite good shape. There are always going to be some casualties in that kind of thing, but looking forward, we see no decline in any of our segments. In fact, we see real growth in some of the existing segments, and I can name a few of those. But within those segments, there are incredibly interesting developments. I haven't really got time to go into those. But in essence, as I look forward over the next 10 or 15 years, notwithstanding this troubled planet we live on, notwithstanding the geopolitics, the socioeconomic stresses of the planet, one thing is coming through very clearly is that demand for air travel remains very, very robust. And therein lies the issues that we will have to face with regards to sustainability, and we're going to talk about that later. But for me, it's a good story. I never believed that it would be anything else. We are organising ourselves in Emirates, as Max said, with 310 aircraft coming in over the next 15 years, and the plans are already laid for where we're going to fly those and what our network is going to look like. And we will deliver that very soon.
Thanks, Tim. And you touched upon this a little bit in your summary then. What do you see as the potential disruptors on the Emirates dashboard? Because obviously you're seeing great signs of strong demand and sustained demand, but there are some concerns out there, geopolitical and obviously aeropolitical. So what, and others?
Well, we've got this ethos. I like to think that we've instilled this in the workforce. There is nothing that's really going to get in our way. We're very much a can-do operation. Any problem we've got, we go around it, under it, over it, and just keep going. We will deal with, we're a very much a global brand now. We're ubiquitous in just about all countries on the planet. And we have to look at what goes on in those countries. So we're very meshed, unfortunately, meshed in the politics of those countries and the sort of socioeconomic issues that drive some of the structures, if you like, of those countries. And when I look around, I see China, I see going south at the moment, I see the European economy is looking a little bit flaky at the moment. I have some real concerns about what that's going to look like. The UK is in a little bit of a political conundrum at the moment. I don't want to get involved in that. I'm an airline manager, not a politician, but what I would say is that the United Kingdom is the most robust market for Emirates on our network. It continues to respond and deliver to us the people that travel on our aircraft very good profits, I'm very pleased to say. 6380s into Heathrow and whatever it is into Gatwick. So there are some a lot of people cannot get their minds around the fact that there seems to be a disconnect between what is actually going out in the real world and what actually you're being portrayed as actually experiencing. Now, I struggle with this because I can see how demand in South America, how demand in North America, China, Jakarta, Indonesia, whatever, it continues to come at us. It matters that, so at some point, for every seat we were selling in our premium cabins, we had three people trying to get it, which of course had a pricing effect. So again, to answer the question, Max, you know, we've got a good team of people. What gets thrown at us, we will deal with, and we have done in the past.
Thank you. And I suppose the one issue that we do know a lot about is the supply side, and that's a real problem for you, I think. Are you surprised how bad, or what a hash, particularly Boeing, but maybe Airbus a little bit as well, has made of trying to ramp up and get the aircraft to the, not just you, to all the airlines at the right speed, and the engine makers coming up with engines that deliver efficiency gains, but hand in hand with really poor durability capabilities?
Well, I got the impression that both sides of the Atlantic, they were asleep at the wheel in the pandemic. They shared the view that the airline industry wasn't going to recover, that demand for new aircraft would diminish. And the whole ethos and the way they thought about it. So we were not at conflict, but we had differences of opinion. Now this was not just the primary aircraft producers, but the whole supply chain shared the view because the aerospace manufacturers were passing messages that they didn't think things were going to recover. If you remember, in 2020, we were told that the demand wouldn't restore itself until 26, 27, 28. And of course, you know, that had an effect on the boards of both Boeing and Airbus as to what they were going to do with their production line. So they took this initiative to start shutting down. When you start shutting down, they seem to be oblivious to the fact that the complexities and the essential nature of the supply chain into them would also die a death. They didn't have the capital robustness to be able to stay in business. But that seemed to be lost on some of the people in the main manufacturing. So as a result, they're reaping the whirlwind now. To try and get that supply chain back in is for me, taking an awful long time. Obviously, it is for them as well. And I'm one of these people that if you see a market, you see an opportunity, you're going to go and get it. And you're going to do whatever it takes to get into that market to get the value that you need out of that market. Now, I would have thought the supply chain, seeing what was coming down the track, there's been no shortage of orders, both in the single aisle and the twins, There's no quads anymore, unfortunately. But there is clear a robust demand for all of that, and we're all being stifled by not only supply chain, but the ability of the manufacturers to get those aircraft out the door. You mentioned Boeing, well, that's another story, but clearly there are issues there. So if there is an impediment to what we're trying to do, it is perhaps that. But having said that, and the realisation that we were always going to be faced, probably over the next 5 or 10 years, the difficulties of the supply chain and the manufacturers getting the aircraft to us, we took the decision to take all our 380s, just about, and most of our 777s, to kicked in a $3 billion refurbishment program. So we're gutting the aeroplanes, rebuilding them with internally with all the latest products that we can bring to the table. So we can keep those going. That gives us, in our arsenal, the ability to maintain the network without having to worry about the foibles of people not being able to deliver aircraft on the time that they said they would. So if we face problems, I know in the arsenal, if you can call it that, I've got a couple of hundred aircraft that are still going to keep going for a long time. So I'm kind of not too much worried about that. I'm a little bit fed up, as you've probably read, about what is going on and the criticality of new products, new aircraft in for reasons of sustainability, fuel efficiency, and all the others. But hey ho, that's life. We've got to keep our business going. We'll keep our business going. Come on, mate.
So you've obviously been telling your friends in Seattle and Toulouse that you told them so, I guess, back in the downturn during COVID. When we met towards the end of 2019, just before COVID, you were expecting your first 777-9s to arrive, I think, in 2020 or 2021. I think the latest guess is sometime next year. Is that about as good as it gets at the moment in terms of guesswork, or have you got any more specific?
Well, the every day is a different day for us. You're right, we should have had our first aircraft in April 2020. After all, we signed for it. We did the first deal at the Dubai Air Show in July 12th or November 12th. So we thought probably 10 years, 9 years was okay. So here we are now going into the end of next year. Frankly, with what's been going on over there and with the FAA's increased surveillance and scrutiny on what they're doing, I'm beginning to doubt that as well, which is what it takes me back to why we're doing what we're doing with the old fleet. So.
And all this delay to new technology coming in is not helping the airlines attempt to address their decarbonisation. This year will be the highest year ever for global emissions from the airline industry. No shock there, because obviously 2019 was the previous high, and there's going to be growth this year. So we need these new aircraft to come in, don't we, to tackle that emission, or at least address the growth. So from your perspective, how realistic are the decarbonisation targets that we have, and what has to be done to make it achievable?
Good
question.
How long have you got? Well, anyway, I kind of, if we talk about the airline industry, this is an industry that has outperformed just about every industry over the last 50 years in the way it goes about its efficiencies, its particularly fuel efficiencies. You know, when I look back at the, dare I say it, the Comet, and I look at the 85% improvement in fuel efficiencies per seat mile compared to that aircraft over the period of years, and what propulsion has been doing, that gets airbrushed in the narrative. But going forward, we have some pretty onerous but difficult targets to achieve 2050 net zero on the carbon emissions. Some countries are going even more draconian on that. I'm trying to inject a little bit of realism into the debate. It's all very well to talk about SAF, and goodness me, if the airline industry could fly on 100% SAF today, of course it would, even though it costs four times the price of a gallon of petrol today, or whatever it may be. But you know, getting there is the biggest single problem that not just the aerospace industry, but decarbonizing the planet in the time that people want us to do that, us being mankind, is a Herculean task and hugely expensive. Even if it doesn't cost less than $1 trillion a year, I'll be very surprised. For the aerospace industry, we're talking about SAF, we're talking about 10% targets by 2030, etc. You know, is that going to pass muster? Is it really going to? Are people going to say in 2030, well, they got 10% out of a 350-900, the 787-9 Dreamliner, probably burn about 7 or 8 tons. an hour, probably 70 if they're lucky. So you're going to save 700 kilos. Does that tick the box beyond 2030? Because after that, the ability to power these engines with fuel technologies that still are in their infancy, and we're talking about 6 years out, okay, is, and given the scale of what I said earlier, demand for air travel continues to grow at 4 or 5% a year. You do the maths on 4 billion plus people traveling a year. Where does that get you to by 2020 and 2035? And is there sufficient feedstock in the SAF markets? I've already got to talk about cooking oils, it's already talking about all these bits and pieces and rubbish and garbage, but you've got to just face the reality that we must look at, and everybody's looking at the technology of hydrogen. I know Guillaume Faury and his Airbus teams are spending an awful lot of time and money on hydrogen-powered aircraft. But of course, the first one will unlikely to come to market, if it does, until the mid-30s or the late 30s.
It'll be under 100 seats.
It'll be 100 seats, and then you've got the eVTOL sort of air taxi situation. These are all very well, but are they going to ever replace something as big as the 380 or something flying these long distances, carrying the payloads that we need according to performance and economics? So I struggle with that. I just feel though that this move to sustainability, decarbonisation is laudable, it's what we need to do, otherwise mankind's going to find itself in a bit of a mess in the next 100 years. Our great-great-grandchildren are going to suffer from what we're not doing. But we've also got to deal with the fact that we are in a transition. We must let technology take its role and do what we can. We must do a lot of other things in and around. I fret that the airframe manufacturers are concentrating on single aisle. They're not talking about the next generation of twin, because there's no quads. And the improvements that we've learned in terms of technology, aerodynamics, propulsion, could produce a new twin, whether it be blended wing or whatever. But they're not doing that. They're absolutely fixated on single aisle and hydrogen and the amount of money that's going into that. That's not going to crack the problem. So what you see today is what you're going to get. 350, 900, 1000 on the right, and on the left the 787-9, the 777-9, which will be the biggest aircraft flying. But after that, nothing else. That's it. Now, where does that take you in terms of your ability to meet your sustainability targets beyond the 40s? Okay, I don't know. I'm not sure. And then, if you honestly believe that you're going to have a hydrogen-powered aircraft which has got a 200 or 300 max takeoff weight flying the distances that it's going to fly on hydrogen, bearing in mind you've got to have an infrastructure to support the flow of hydrogen into the aircraft at the places you're going to go to, this is a massive, massive undertaking, hugely expensive, and I don't see the private investment, private capital coming into those infrastructural changes. I don't see the amount of money that governments have got to put into all the other sides of the this sort of jigsaw, so it's a very difficult one. But we kind of we try and persuade and do the right thing, which we're trying to do. I mean, I'd love to see airports, places like Heathrow, and don't taxi out with the engines running. Tow the aircraft out to the end of the runway, great, and be busy.
There's been electric taxi projects, but they've never come to fruition. On the subject of 2040, do you think you'll still be President of Emirates then? Or is it, how's the Tim Clark succession planning going?
Well, actually, I'm not here with you at the moment. This is holistic. This is a hologram that floated into the room earlier. Now, of course, you know, everybody will face that eventually when we must retire and whatever. And you know, we've got a good team of people.
The Emirates announced last week.
We moved 19 people into more senior positions. This was in preparation for not for my departure, more about preparing the airline for the next stage, what I call the third epoch, where we're going to shock and stun people over the next 20 years. And believe me, there's an awful lot coming with Emirates, and I just wanted to get everything in place so it can move. And the only way you can move is with your team of people. You're only as good as your people. Or whoever suggests otherwise is talking nonsense. Your people have got the people to take you on and do what you need to do. So that's what will happen.
Just coming back to a couple of Emirates issues in terms of fleet. and then there'll be a Q&A, so don't worry, I'm going to hand over to the audience. The A350, you ordered some, sorry, the A350-900 you ordered at Dubai. Absent was an order for the A350-1000, and you were quite public with your thoughts on the problem there. And other people have talked about that as well. Is there going to be an A350-1000 order? Are you hearing good things from Rolls? You think they have announced some initiatives around the 1000's durability, I know, last week?
I think, I was fairly vocal. I was deeply disappointed with that we couldn't have what we needed on that engine. But it was more about the fact that Airbus have only two big aircraft at the top of its range now, the 350-1000 and the 350-900. They have nothing else. So if you can't get the propulsor on the biggest aircraft they've got, what are you going to do? So it's more of an issue, not just for Emirates, because we hadn't bought them. We weren't in a distress situation. But for the industry faced with, as I said, an acute shortage of what's coming next, and given the demand that I mentioned, this engine had to be fixed, and fixed soon. So yes, they've made undertakings to us. Yes, we've listened to them. Tufan is now very focused on the 97K engine. Because I think he realises, of course, that without that, and I can assure you that Guillaume Faury and Christian Scherer and Airbus are sitting on his shoulder all the time. So he told me last week that he committed £1 billion or something to try and sort the engine out. But he knows what we want, what it's going to have to do for us. Good luck. We said, we're very supportive. We like the aeroplane. We think if you can get the engine sorted out, it'll do great things for us. But we're not going to buy it until we know that it actually works. So that's how it is.
Okay, thanks. One last question then, the floor. I call them the Emirates impersonators. There's been a growing band of Emirates impersonators, really, for the last couple of decades, but even more so now, these kind of national network players that we're seeing, and obviously in your region particularly. How is Emirates going to cope with that competition? You've dealt with it in the past successfully. Do you see anything that concerns you, or do you just think it's going to be business as usual?
As you said, we dealt with it in the past as the boss of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, often says, if they want to imitate us, that's the best form of flattery, as he would say in his Arabic manner. And he's very proud of the fact that we have kind of instilled in the Middle East, strangely enough, 50 years ago, who would have dreamt it, this spawning the idea of, based on the Emirates business model, being able to connect the planet over the Middle East, over these points. So, I've never. Sometimes it's kept me up at night. I have to be quite honest. But at the end, I have a firm belief in what we can do, and that the more noise there is about what we do, the more easy I sleep in my bed. It's when there's silence that's where I get a little bit concerned. So far there's always noise, and as long as there's noise, I know we're doing the right thing, and they're worried about us. So that's fine, no problem.
And this coming year, the year that I think you finish at the end of March, are you expecting that to be a new high for Emirates in terms of passenger numbers, or is it still a recovery year, the last year that we're in through to March? I think it was 59 million was your peak in 2017 and 18. Are you sort of back to those numbers?
No, we're not back to those numbers. As you said, we've got another 380s on the ground having a lot of restoration work because they were sitting around doing nothing for so long. When we get those back in again, we'll push the numbers back up again. So we probably weren't closing passenger number quite where we were then, but we're not far behind. But everything else is working.
And the 380s should all be back this year?
We'll probably get the last one out of the shop probably in early 26.
Okay.
It's a long process. A lot of structural work had to be done.
Yeah, there's the wing, there's the cracks, and there's also the gear overhauls as well. Quite tiny, aren't they? Okay. Well, with that, thank you to Tim for the formal part. So, round of applause, please. We've skated around lots of topics, but I'm sure there's questions in the room from my former colleagues in the media world, so hands up. In fact, Alan, do you want to give it to Alan first?
Hello, okay. Alan John from Air Transport World. I noticed last week that the vertical takeoff taxi people are going to be building their hub in Dubai directly outside Terminal 3 at the airport. Do you have any plans to link up in some way with with those people to perhaps have people stepping off one of your flights and onto an air taxi?
Well, obviously, you're right. They have made some announcements about all that. I'm not actually, surprisingly as it may seem, party to what really is going on there. And I'm not quite sure where the regulator is in all of this with regard to electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. If there is an opportunity, then we will certainly be talking to them. But at the moment, we haven't really engaged other than we'll just watch and see what happens. They've got a lot of testing to do yet. I hope they've got their performance calculations absolutely right, given the extreme nature of the temperatures in the summer. I'm sure they have. This is they can carry these payloads. But once they get all that sorted, I'm sure we'll be talking to them.
Thank you. Malcolm? Also, was there one? Malcolm?
Two questions.
You only allow one.
Tim, when are our grandchildren likely to be booking, you're a bit younger than me, on the last 380 flight? And going the opposite extreme, what do you hear from Boeing on the 777X?
First question, we will probably keep our 380 subject to supply check and all the other things going to the late 30s. We've got plenty of time yet. Okay. What was the second we talked about the 7X, probably at the back end of next year, maybe in 26, if we're unlucky.
Are you the first recipient?
I don't think so.
I
think so. We took the opportunity on the delay to re-design all the products, to bring the technology of the later generation and stuff in.
Right. I've got other questions if no one else has. Any other questions in the room? Bill at the back, and then just turn.
Tim, my apologies, but I think you've answered the question previously. Due to the investment you're making on the 380s, would it be safe to assume that anybody in the financial or leasing community can expect those leases to be extended on their present terms?
So long as we have these lease structures, not all of them on the leases, but where we have financial structures in place, they will probably they'll drop out simply because they'll be going on for much longer. The aircraft will be flying for much longer. As regards the continuum of their terms, obviously we'll be talking to the lessors and the people who are interested in with us. And sometimes I regret having said you're going to keep these aircraft on when they were made, obviously, because all the lessors and the banks rub their hands and think, we got it.
So far, so good. The aircraft is well worth keeping. It's a hugely profitable machine for us. So I think we'll have that conversation a bit later on, probably well enough around. Okay, one here,
then, at the back.
Hello, Rhys Jones from Head Points. Just going back to the Rolls-Royce announcement from last week, if their promises come true, and I believe that's doubling the time on wing in hostile conditions such as in Dubai, would that be sufficient for Emirates, or are you looking for even more or even further improvements?
The time on wing at the moment is about 500 cycles. We need 2,500, so I don't know where the doubling came from, but we're not there yet by any sort of condition. I think what they're trying to do is get to something like 2,000 cycles under our conditions, but it depends on the stage length that you're talking about. And at a price per hour that is affordable for us. Rolls have been pretty aggressive in their pricing structures recently, and I think they lost one or two contracts as a result. But certainly, if you get all those in the sweet spot of performance, costs, etc., etc., we'll be talking to them. Seriously, they know that. They've already done enormous and complicated designs of the interiors of the 351,000. With a typical sort of Emirates signature in terms of the products we're going to put on it. They all came to full stop because of that.
So we'll see. Tim, can I just ask on that point? You said that the aggressive pricing has lost them into contracts. The
that's on A350, that means Airbus has lost contracts. Or are you talking on 7-8 where there's a choice of engines?
No, I think in this particular case, I don't want to name the carrier, but it was the 351 pounds, which was the 1,000 couldn't do what they wanted to do or whatever. Or I think it could, but there was a pricing issue, and eventually they bought.
I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah. Okay. At the back, Shashank.
Sir Tim Shashank, I think I'm simply flying. You mentioned the huge cost of decarbonisation. SAF is $4 or four times the price of jet fuel. Singapore recently announced that they will be charging passengers a levy for SAF on every flight that departs from 2026. Who's going to pay for this? Do you think Dubai or the government and you are going to step in for passengers to pay? Will the lessors be paying this with SAF included as part of the aircraft? Who's going to foot the cost?
Well, it's a very good question. It's not just the Singaporeans. We've seen the Norwegians, we've seen the Swiss, we've seen the French. They are introducing fairly draconian measures. Some are invariably financial. And if you introduce a set of measures where you are trying to achieve something which is physically not achievable, there will be problems. So whether the Singapore government have a decarbonisation program, which is fairly draconian, but they seem hell-bent on getting it done, I'm a little bit surprised because Singapore Airlines is the lifeblood of Singapore. And without Singapore Airlines, I don't know whether Singapore would have the persona, charisma of what it has today, but it was very important to it. Now, they will suffer, and in the end, you ask where this is going to go. I'm afraid to say it's going to go onto the airfares. Whether we like it or not, the airline industry can absorb so much, and actually at the moment we're fairly profitable as an industry, but going forward, I'm not sure that's going to stay there forever. But if in the end there is a recognition in the travelling public that the cost of fuel won't be four times then, because they were scaled by then, but let's say it's double, then if you are going to run things, it's going to cost more to fly. And you will appease your conscience because you will have SAF, but people seem to think that SAF is going to give you a zero emission. Well, it ain't. Okay? There's always going to be stuff coming out of the back of those engines, whatever you do. But it's a step in the right direction. I get concerned that a number of countries are becoming very draconian in their mandates. They say things like, you have to have, your airports must have provision for SAF fuel. And the airports say, we haven't got the money to do that. And then they say to the manufacturers, the multinationals, you will produce this amount of fuel for this country. They said we haven't got enough production capability to do that. But to get there, we had to spend $500 million converting refineries to everything else. And then they say, well, to the airlines, if you don't uplift the fuel that you know you haven't got and they can't produce, you're going to be fine. Which is what's going to happen. So we'll say, well, hang on, here we are ready to open our tanks and take everything we can grow us. But guess what? There's none there. And even if there was, there'd be lots of other carriers trying to get access to that minimal stock. We've seen BA get involved in it. We've got our own arrangements with the solar cluster. We've got with the Singaporeans themselves. We've got arrangements with the Dutch. We're trying to do as much as we can. But 0.1% of the 550 million tonnes of aviation fuel that is burnt a year prior to COVID is today SAF. So how are you going to go and scale to even 6% or 10%? By the time they want us to do it? I just say, guys, just be reasonable. Let's look at the whole the calculus of all the stakeholders involved in this to see what is really achievable if we go flat out. So good luck.
And that rise in cost of travel is going to be a drag on growth, business industry growth, of course. So unfortunately, we're running out of time. One question for Murdo, and then I'll be passing to five. So, Murdo.
I'll be very quick. Murdo Morrison from Flight Global. So, Tim, can you talk a little bit about the relationship with Fly Dubai? We've seen Fly Dubai move into wide bodies. How does that relationship work going forward in terms of, working alongside them, working with what the route networks are? Do you see a time of closer cooperation? That's very quick. I'm also about DWC, Albert Tomb Airport. Do you see, at what point do you see Emirates making the move to the new airport?
Well, as far as Fly Dubai is concerned, the plan I alluded to earlier significantly involves them in what we're going to do. We'll be bolted at the hip. So the notion that two carriers working together over the next 10 or 15 years will produce a network, both medium, short and long haul, which will be one of the largest in the world. And their acquisition of 787-9s in 26-27 will allow them to go to places that ordinarily we wouldn't think of going to, that they have ideas to go to. So they'll just add value to the combined networks. The synergy, the wealth creation, the value creation of the two working together will be very, very significant. As far as DWC is concerned, we can't do this without DWC at some point in the future. And we're waiting for the government to give its go-ahead on that. Significant planning is already in train at the moment to deal with that. I'm not going to say what it is. This is for the government of Dubai to announce. But I will say this, it is going to be very significant when it comes.
And in the meantime, DXB, is it 85 million? Is that, you're going to squeeze up to 120 million before... transition for
the... I think Paul Griffith, who runs the airport, would love that. The difficulties at the moment is if you equalise the demand over the working day, that would be achievable. Your problem is the peaks. And our banks, I've got 140 departures in 3 hours, all of them wide bodied. The pressure on the roads, the pressure on the whole system around the airport comes under, and also air traffic control, etc. So as we expand the fleet, it's not a question of whether they can take another 10 or 15 million. It's whether or not the peaks will take that. I'm not sure they will. We'll see.
Okay, thank you. We won't even go down the Heathrow Airport route today. We've got time to do that. But anyway, with that, I'd like to thank Tim and pass back to Clive.
You may remember, Tim, that you don't leave here empty-handed as a speaker. So,
thank you, sir.